Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. Today, we're discussing how Hungary, once a thriving democracy, slipped into autocratic rule. Since 2010, Prime Minister Viktor Orban, a Donald Trump ally, and his Fidesz party have consolidated power, dismantled checks and balances, and taken control of universities, civil society, and the media. The ruling Fidesz party now control 80% of the country's media, according to Reporters Without Borders. Klub Radio, the last major independent radio station, was banned in 2021. Last week, Indymedia, a pro-Orban group, bought Blick, Hungary's most read tabloid, which has published many pieces on alleged corruption. The Guardian reports that staffers were shocked. The purchase comes less than 6 months before April's general election. Polls show that Viktor Orban and his party have a real challenger for the first time in more than a decade. In 2022, the U.S. Conservative Political Action Conference was held in Budapest. Viktor Orban told Republicans to, quote, have your own media. It is the only way to point out the insanity of the progressive left, end quote. CPAC also held their conference in Hungary last year and this May. The CPAC Hungary site says Hungary has become the epicenter of the global fight against globalism. And then there are social issues. Abortion is legal up to 12 weeks in Hungary, but those seeking abortions must listen to, quote, fetal vital signs and take part in mandatory counseling sessions. Hungary ranks among Europe's worst countries for access to contraception and family planning, according to the European Policy Atlas. Women with four or more children in Hungary are exempt from paying personal income taxes for life. Hungary's constitution says children should be raised in accordance with values based on Hungary's constitutional identity and Christian culture. In 2022, Hungary banned any discussion of gender and sexual diversity in schools, the media, and advertising. In April, Hungary's parliament passed an amendment to the constitution stating that it recognizes two sexes, prohibits same-sex adoption, bans public events by LGBTQ+ communities, and allows authorities to use facial recognition tools to identify people who attend those events. In June, tens of thousands of people defied the ban by taking part in Budapest Pride. Hungary is a small Central European country with 9.5 million people. Joining us to talk about what we can learn from what has happened in Hungary and to talk about effective resistance and what's to come are two guests. Dr. Gábor Sherin is assistant professor of comparative politics at Georgetown University in Qatar. Professor Sherin was a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014, where he advocated for a socially just transition to sustainability. He pursued his PhD in sociology from the University of Cambridge, where he explored the intersection of economic shocks, inequality, and democratic resilience. His book, The Retreat of Liberal Democracy, examines how working class dislocation and business elite co-optation foster illiberalism. Professor Sherin is working on two books. One explores the politics of deaths of despair and democracy, and another focuses on the structural forces behind the rise of authoritarianism populism. And Professor Sherin joins us from Qatar. Hi, Professor Sherin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
We're also joined by András Peto, a Hungarian journalist and co-founder and director of Direct 36, an independent investigative news outlet. Direct 36 is one of the very few outlets in Hungary that are not under the government's influence. In 2014, András Peto resigned from Origo, one of Hungary's leading independent news outlets, after management pressured journalists to drop stories that the government did not like. András has worked with the BBC World Service and the Washington Post. His award-winning reporting has focused on corruption and the rise of Prime Minister Orban, earning him Hungary's prestigious Soma Prize twice. He's been a World Press Institute Fellow and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. András first interviewed Orban in 2006 and has not interviewed him since. And András Peto joins us from Budapest. Hi, András. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Thank you so much. This is going to be such an important show. Before we dive in and talk about what happened in 2010 and how we got to this point in Hungary, can you both share a bit about your background? Dr. Shering, why don't we start off with you? Why did you decide to get into politics? It's interesting to learn that you were a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament in 2010, and that is when we saw these major changes with Orban and the Fidesz party.
Yes, I was indeed elected to the Hungarian Parliament the same year when Viktor Orbán catapulted to power, so to speak. So I was coming, our party was coming from this kind of progressive green movement that was growing throughout the 2000s in the country. And by the end of the 2000s, quite a few of us were heavily dissatisfied with the way the country was headed, and we wanted to contribute to a better direction, a more just and a sustainable country. But we were hoping that we could do that with the traditional tools of democracy. But alas, Orban Viktor had other plans, so we found ourselves very early on fighting against his autocratic rule. But my personal motivation came from this kind of 2000s activist subculture, and also my family background, which is a kind of I grew up in a working class family, and the 90s wasn't kind of the best period in the life of my family, both financially and also health wise. So you mentioned one of the books that I'm working on is on how economic shocks influence people's health, and that's what I've seen in the country. And by the way, this is, I think, also playing out in parts of the US. So these health inequalities also fuel the rise of illiberalism. But maybe we get to talk about that briefly later on.
Can you tell us what Hungary was like before Orban? Hungary had its first free elections in 1990, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that time?
You know, it was a country that was emerging out of socialism in the 90s, early 90s. I think many people were quite hopeful that it's going to just become your regular, boring, democratic country in Europe. That was the direction it was headed. There were huge problems, social and economic problems in during the early years of the transformation, but people kind of said, okay, this is a short-term period and hopefully it will get better. But then economic crisis situations kept on happening again and again, and during the 2000s we saw that playing out multiple times, even with the Socialist Liberal Party in power. Before the 2008 financial crisis there were difficulties already with the situation of the economy. So there was this kind of interesting mix of hope and also growing frustration with the way the country was governed. So there was also a yearning for change throughout those periods. But it was more or less, you know, like your regular European liberal democracy at that time until the end of the 2000s.
Dr. Gábor Sharing was a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014. He's now Assistant Professor of Comparative Politics at Georgetown University in Qatar. We're also joined by András Pethő, a Hungarian journalist and co-founder and director of Direct 36, one of the very few outlets in Hungary that are not under the government's influence. Why don't you tell us a bit about your background, András, and how you got into journalism and what it was like when you saw major changes from Orban and his party starting in 2010?
So I got my first real journalism job in 2002, and that was the year when the first term of Viktor Orban ended, because he was in power between 98 and 2002, and he lost that election in 2002, which was quite unexpected. He was beaten by the coalition of socialists and liberals. But in fact, I pretty soon after university, when I moved to Budapest to start working at this news outlet, Origo, that you mentioned before. So, and I started in September 2002. So that was months after the election. So actually, I spent the first 8 years of my career reporting more mostly on the socialist and liberal government. So, and actually, one of the things that I also think a lot that why was it so easy for Viktor Orban to build up his regime, and why was it so easy to dismantle for him the democratic institutions? And I think one of the reasons is that the previous 8 years under the socialist liberal coalition was a really turbulent time. There was a lot of maybe they were on the progressive side when it was, when it came to like social values and ideas, but it was a pretty incompetent and also quite corrupt government. So, and their rule, they almost the country almost went bankrupt during the 2008 financial crisis. It was one of the first countries that needed help from the IMF and the European Commission. So I think it was not a surprise that Viktor Orban could come back with a bang, with a landslide in 2010. And also probably people didn't really care so much about the institutions, because they didn't feel that they're protected them or served them well in the previous years.
I was curious about that, Andres, because Hungary has about 9.5 million people. Do you know how many people are eligible to vote and how many people do vote in your elections?
Oh, actually, that's a, I don't know, the top of my head, yeah, I mean, of course you can exclude I don't know, maybe like 1.5, 2 million people, but maybe Gabor knows these figures better than me. And the turnout is I think the highest turnout we had was in 2002, actually, and I think it was like 70%
Oh,
back then. But in general, for the general elections, it's between 60 and 70. I hope I'm not wrong.
yeah, I
I'm always
think there are kind of
Professor
8 million
Sherry.
people, more or less. I'm also not fully aware, like cognizant of the actual numbers, but let's say around 8 million. And more or less it fluctuates around 5 million, the number of people who actually turn out to vote.
I'm always curious about this because in the United States, we often hear that half of the country voted for Trump when that's not true. Half the country actually did not vote. So it's about 27, 28% voted for Trump. Professor Sharon, can you also talk about what allowed Viktor Orban to move in these directions in 2010? And when he started consolidating power, what was the response from the media and from Hungarians?
Yeah, I think Andras was really m referring to a crucial phenomenon that is also I hinted at this mixture of hope and massive disillusionment with the country's elites. And a part of that disillusionment was related to how people felt alienated from mainstream liberal institutions. So the country had pretty decent constitution and all the kind of the institutional bits that you would associate with a well-functioning democracy were there. But yet people felt that neither those institutions, and particularly those elites who always talk about defending democracy, that is the previous socialist liberal governing coalition, the majority of people felt that these elites and those institutions do not care for them. So why should they care about those institutions or about those elites? So that's really the situation that you want to avoid. It's not enough for a democracy to have these good institutions. People have to feel at home and listened to, and their voices need to be incorporated, and democracy has to also kind of perform socially and economically. And you know, just to give you, I could give you thousands of numbers, but perhaps the best or one of the best numbers is if you look at the data from Piketty's International Inequalities Database, you can really trace individual incomes of different social categories in Hungary. So those of the lower and middle class, their real wage or real income around 2010, when Viktor Orban was elected, was still lower from where it was around the mid-80s. That is still like the last decade of socialism. So you have 2 decades of real income stagnation. It's a very similar situation like you had in the US in 2016 when Donald Trump was elected. You have a lot of working class, middle class anger directed against liberals or smallly and largely Democrats. So I think that's a crucial element. And this is what really was Viktor Orban was capitalizing on. He could also build an alliance with parts of the economic elite who also felt kind of frustrated by heavy competition from foreign investors. Hungary is a small country, and the majority of its economy is owned and operated by foreign investors, mostly German corporations. So if you are just your regular Hungarian investor, you have to face this stiff competition. And some of them wanted economic nationalist protection from the state. And this is something that Viktor Orban delivered. So he kind of could sell his regime to both these regular working class folks as well as parts of the economic elite. And then he used this kind of really strong position to build up his own very strong loyalist kind of group of, you know, I'm here as a political scientist, but maybe I can use the word plutocrats or oligarchs. So these are really strongly connected businessmen that Viktor Orbán used to also create his own economic hinterland. So whenever he loses election, he has, you know, his extra governmental kind of fortifications, financial and institutional fortifications on which he can fall back on.
It's also important to point out, and you wrote about this in one of your many pieces that you've written about Orban, is that Orban's government gerrymandered local districts and allowed voters to register outside their home districts, both aimed at favoring Orban and his party. In a piece you wrote for The Conversation, you write that Republicans in the U.S. have followed a similar trajectory with the support of Trump as his rhetoric grows more authoritarian. So, Professor Sharon, can you tell us more about gerrymandering and how it also, what role it played in all of this?
Sure. Although I think, as the word itself suggests, it's something that it's a beautiful invention, mostly coming from the United States to arriving to Hungary. But then Orban really doubled down on it. And not just local electoral districts, but he rewrote the whole electoral system in a way that very clearly favors his own political party. So that's a very important element of how the democratic game is played, the kind of the electoral system. But democracies consist of other crucial institutions. And he made sure that over the years that he one way or another controls all these institutions and restructures them in a way that helps him to stay in power. So, you know, the prosecutor's office is controlled by a loyalist. So whenever something happens, there's a scandal that should hurt the government, the prosecutor's office can always make sure to slow down the procedure or not even begin a procedure. So that's just like one element. One of the last things that they're trying to also control is the judiciary. There's, of course, the whole slew of efforts to restructure the media landscape, right? And I'm sure that Andras can talk about this in great detail. And that's also a really important part of it. And this is also like a mutual learning between US revolutionary conservatives, the alt-right, Hungary's new illiberal conservatives, learn from them, and then also perfect the methods. It's kind of a laboratory of illiberalism, so that Trump and his team then can learn from Hungary. So maybe some of the listeners are aware of Project 2025 by the Heritage Foundation that explicitly references Viktor Orbán's Hungary and his authoritarian playbook as a kind of a guiding principle and playbook that that they have to follow, and they indeed follow it throughout these institutional kind of restructuring efforts. So it's a really complex playbook affecting the totality of institutions, so that you can still get to vote in Hungary. There are elections, but the playing field is so much tilted. I would not say it's impossible, because as long as there are elections, it's still possible to get rid of the government. But it's just like the opposition has a really, really tough job of actually achieving that goal.
Before we talk about the media, Gabor, a number of outlets point out that polls are showing that Viktor Orban and his party have a real challenger for the first time in more than a decade. And you've got your next election in April. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean the polls are very clear about that. Throughout most of the year, the opposition, which is now a pretty new opposition, it's an interesting, in some ways bizarre situation that the opposition is now led by a young leader who, until recently, was so basically he came from the Fidesz ecosystem, but he is now a very clear challenger who is leading by a very significant margin. So Hungarians now really have, for the first time, a situation where the opposition has been leading for month and month. And I think the most important reason for this is really economic. So the regime has really exhausted its own economic reserves. The things that Viktor Orbán was talking about, the whole economic nationalist agenda, didn't really play out. It actually just intensified Hungary's dependencies. Orbán lost many of the EU funds that were always very important for the Hungarian economy to grow. Actually, Donald Trump's America First foreign policy, the trade war, hurts Europe economically, Germany especially. And you know, when it comes to hurting Germany, it hurts Hungary, because Hungarian economy is pretty much a hinterland of the German economy. So these things explain why the Hungarian economy, these external kind of shocks, and the way the internal domestic vulnerability of the economy interact, why he lost his popularity. If you look at the wages, median wages of Hungarians when Viktor Orbán took over, compared to the 10 freshly countries that freshly joined the European Union, the 10 Eastern European members, Hungary was roughly in the upper middle kind of segment of those 10 countries. Now, in 2025, Hungary is the last in terms of the real value of wages. So that's a clear disaster. So that is what you can see in the polls, plus the fact that now you have a position that is not divided, that is not tainted by figures from the old opposition that Andras was also referring to. So you have a new situation that is, I think, really important both for Hungarians, but also, you know, globally. Perhaps we're having this conversation, you know, also because Hungary matters for everyone interested in democracy and in liberalism. The country has become such a kind of symbolic place for these fights. So I do think that you know, if Orbán loses the election, it's not just a new phase for Hungary, but it's really a symbolically important moment in the story of democracy globally.
Well, we're going to take a quick break today on Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series. We're talking about how Hungary, once a democracy, became what experts call an electoral autocracy. Since 2010, Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party have consolidated power, dismantled checks and balances, and taken control of universities, civil society, and 80% of the media. Dr. Gábor Sherin is assistant professor of comparative politics at Georgetown University in Qatar. He was a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014. András Pethő is a Hungarian journalist and co-founder and director of Direct 36. Now it is one of the very few outlets in Hungary that are not under the government's influence. It is also independent. In 2014, András resigned from Origo, one of Hungary's leading independent news outlets, after management pressured journalists to drop stories that the government did not like. András is joining us from Budapest. If you have any questions for our guests today, we are asking them about what happened to Hungary. How did it get to this point? What can we learn from Hungarians about resisting authoritarianism and what's to come? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about Hungary, once a thriving democracy, slipped into autocratic rule. We're talking with two Hungarians about how Hungary got to this place and the lessons we can learn from Hungary about resisting authoritarianism and what's to come. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Dr. Gábor Sherin, assistant professor of comparative politics at Georgetown University in Qatar. He was a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014. He's the author of The Retreat of Liberal Democracy. He's working on a book about the politics of death, of despair and democracy, and another book about the structural forces behind the rise of authoritarian populism. We're also joined by András Pethő, a Hungarian journalist and co-founder and director of Direct 36, an independent investigative news outlet in Hungary. It is now one of the very few outlets in Hungary that are not under the government's influence. András, I said earlier that at the 2022 U.S. Conservative Political Action Conference in Budapest, Viktor Orban told Republicans to have your own media. It is the only way to point out the insanity of the progressive left. And you felt Orban's crackdown personally when you were working at the popular news site Origo. You and a number of other journalists decided to step down after management pressured you to drop stories the government didn't like. So can you tell us about when you saw major changes with the media under Orban and then what you experienced at Origo?
Sure. Well, actually, to understand Orban and his approach to power is, you know, the you can understand that through the his approach to media, and I'm not here to give you a history lesson about, you know, the modern history of Hungary, but to understand Orban, we need to go back to the early 90s, because when he was still a young politician, he was the one of the leading figures of this young liberal party, Fidesz. And they, in the first few years, they were pretty popular among journalists, and I think they had a pretty positive coverage in the media. But then when in the 92, 93, when for various reasons they started to move towards the center and to the right, and then they also got critical with the media, then this, you know, of course, this relationship ended, and then, you know, they almost fell out of the parliament. They almost didn't get into the parliament in the next elections in 94. And Orban blamed the media for much of this. In 96, he gave a famous interview in which he said that he thinks that the media is one of the most dangerous things in the world. Then he corrected himself, and then he said that perhaps the most dangerous thing in the world. So it's like, I think that explains a lot about what happened later. So when he came back to power in 2010, then media was one of the priorities. I think, as far as I remember, but maybe Gabor can co correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the media, a new media law, a new media constitution, as they called it, was the first, or one of the first pieces of legislation that was introduced into the parliament. And that totally redesigned the regulatory framework of media in Hungary. They set up a new authority. They appointed people who were loyal to Fidesz in key positions. And then they went after the public media. In Hungary, we have a kind of like a BBC style public broadcaster system, and they turned that into a mouthpiece for the government pretty quickly. And then they started to go after private media companies as well. And unfortunately, that news website where I was working at the time, Origo, was one of the first targets. It was a since it was a media outlet that was owned by a telecommunications company. It was pretty easy for the government to put pressure on them, because the telecommunications business is very much exposed to government regulation. They have all kinds of contracts, and so they have to maintain a good relationship with the government. So, you know, in that sense, it was not an ideal owner for a media, a news website. But anyhow, we around 2013, we started to feel that even though Origo, this news website, had been a good place to do journalism for a long time, and that things changed, and then we felt that our own management started to put pressure on us. They were telling us not to pursue certain stories that were uncomfortable for the government, and it was clear that they did that because they were under pressure from the government or some politicians. And then when, you know, it was clear for us that we cannot continue doing our job independently, and we didn't have the editorial freedom anymore, then I resigned, and many other people resigned. And then actually the same scenario played out with various other outlets in Hungary. This has become a pattern, basically, that because then Origo, this news site, what happened to that was that it was sold to a pro-government company or pro-government businessman pretty soon after, and then that's what happened with many other outlets. And you know, and some of these outlets were transformed into propaganda organizations, just like as it happened with Origo, or some other outlets were just shut down, like what happened with Népszabadság, which was the biggest opposition newspaper and biggest paper and opposition newspaper. It was shut down as part of a takeover operation.
The Guardian reports, based on Reporters Without Borders, that while Hungarian journalists are not or only rarely subject to physical assault or unjustified police interrogation, the Hungarian state is the only European Union member to have arbitrarily monitored journalists using the Pegasus software. In addition, in the context of smear campaigns, journalists critical of the government are harassed online by supporters of the ruling party. So, Andres, you are co-founder and director of Direct 36. This is an independent investigative news outlet in Hungary, now one of the very few outlets. You're joining us from Budapest. What is it like for you and your colleagues? I'm looking at the English version of your site right now, and you all do such important work. I'll just mention a few of these stories. The government cracked down on expensive lending, but a loophole remained. Inside the fall of Viktor Orban's secret Brussels spy network, Laurent Mezaros, the wealthy friend of Viktor Orban, is behind a construction project of Orban's father. You've got links between the central bank scandal and the son of its former governor. So many important stories. So what is it like for you and your colleagues to report on these pieces today inside of Hungary?
Yes, Hungary has become this strange place that it's like it's obviously not a healthy, vibrant democracy anymore. but it's not a, you know, it's not a totalitarian dictatorship either. So it's this in this gray zone. And what this means for journalists is that, yes, you can still do this job, you know, but you have to pay a price for that, you know, and that price can be that, you know, that was also not a, I was not planning my career this way, that I will, you know, set up a new organization with my colleagues. And, you know, I was just a reporter. I was just a journalist. I had no idea how to build an organization from scratch, especially in a hostile environment. So it took a lot of work and a lot of effort. But then the other price that you have to pay is, like, as you mentioned, you know, the two of my colleagues were those journalists who two of my colleagues were also surveilled with the Pegasus spyware. So that's certainly not a pleasant experience. And of course, the constant campaigns, smear campaigns against journalists. You know, we are routinely labeled as foreign agents or traitors to the country. So it's not, I'm not aware of physical threats or attacks against journalists in Hungary, but the verbal, the propagandistic attacks have become constant. And obviously, you know, this is not a nice environment to work in. But it's still not like, you know, if you go just, you know, a few hundred miles or kilometers to the east or to the south, I think there are countries where it's much more difficult. Like, you know, we are still not Turkey, where journalists go to jail because of their work, or, you know, or fortunately, you know, journalists don't are not subject to physical attacks, at least for now, so far. And I hope, you know, it will stay like this.
On today's Your Call, it's our Authoritarian Playbook series, and we're talking about what we can learn from Hungarians about resisting authoritarianism and what's to come. Andras Petho is a Hungarian journalist and co-founder and director of Direct 36, an independent investigative news outlet in Hungary. Dr. Gábor Sherin is assistant professor of comparative politics at Georgetown University in Qatar. He was a Green Party member of the Hungarian parliament from 2010 to 2014. In the remaining time we have, I'd love for both of you to talk about what your thoughts are about what we are experiencing here in the United States. We did a series on Project 2025 last year, and the second Trump term is very different from the first Trump term. In the first Trump term, you had Republicans and conservatives standing up to Trump. And one of the main things that we learned in Project 2025 is that that would not happen in the second term because people had to be very loyal to Trump to work in his administration. And that is what we are seeing. So there's unprecedented loyalty. So many people are afraid to speak out and use their names. I don't think I've seen this as a journalist before, hearing so many people saying they're afraid to talk. You have a number of judges who are sounding alarm bells, some anonymously, some not. There's a judge, Mark Wolf, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He's getting a lot of attention for his Atlantic piece called Why I Am Resigning. He says, "I can no longer bear to be restrained by what judges can say publicly or do outside the courtroom. Trump is using the law for partisan purposes, targeting his adversaries while sparing his friends and donors from investigation, prosecution, and possible punishment." So there's that. Members of his own party are afraid to speak out because we're heavily armed in this country and they're afraid of receiving death threats. This has happened. Sadly, politicians have been shot and killed in this country. We're seeing very wealthy people buy up media outlets. We're seeing ICE in cities grabbing people from the streets, immigrants, brown and black people, and their families have no idea where they're taken. I can go on and on, but I would love to hear from both of you. What similarities do you see in this country? What warnings do you have for people living under Trump? And just your overall thoughts about where we are in the US. Gabor, what are your thoughts?
Oh, it's a huge topic, and the topic, you know, I work with quite a few Americans, and Like we can talk about this for hours, but all these things that you listed will sound one way or another familiar to Hungarians. But frankly, not just Hungarians, but many countries where you see an advanced level of autocratization or this authoritarian playbook playing out, it's there are a lot of similarities in this pattern. So one of the big lessons I think is that there is such a thing that we might want to call the illiberal international. So they are learning from each other and they are cooperating and they're sharing tactics with each other. So I think it's also important that people who are interested in democracy, renewing democracy, I think we have to talk to each other more and learn from each other. So if I may share kind of advice, that's something I think crucial. If you look at how the American version of the media authority FCC is being used to pressure media, how the administration is using state funds when it comes to, for example, universities to threaten them to withdraw funds or actually withdrawing funds to kind of make them fall in line, cut that gender studies program here, push back against the diversity agenda there. So that's again a very familiar way of handling kind of unwanted voices and establish supremacy of this kind of radical nationalist conservatism. And if I may add one more thing, is that there's this famous interview that Viktor Orban gave in 2002 when he lost the election. And he said that we were governing, but we were not in power. And I think Trump had a similar feeling and came to the same conclusion. And that is just not enough to govern in a regular way. They want to completely restructure the state and all the other institution structures and even the soft components, that is discourses and ideologies and the way we think about the world and we conceive ourselves and the future. So these soft ideological elements, they also want to change that. So they want a completely new kind of hegemony, as political scientists call it. And Orban is clearly doing that. That's why he is rebuilding the cultural sphere. That's why he is conquering universities, kicking out the one American university that he was not able to control. He's funding think tanks. And you can see the same thing playing out in the US. So they are not in the business of governing, they are in the business of building all encompassing soft and hard structures of power. And I think this is what we need to recognize, and this is what we need to push back against.
Right, because when you think about all of the federal government workers that have lost their jobs, just defunding so many critical social programs here and also abroad. And another question, Gabor, before we hear from Andras. So you are a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament. Because of the way our system works in the United States, it's almost impossible for a member of the Green Party to become a senator or a congressperson, let alone a president. The system is so undemocratic, and it just doesn't allow for independent voices at that national level because of money and politics and other issues. What are your thoughts about that? And then what really strikes you about what you're seeing from the Democratic Party in the US and how they're responding to Trump?
The US is a very interesting beast when it comes to democracy. On the one hand, a lot of people from around the world look at it as a kind of, beacon of democracy, as they like to say. But then if you really look at the depths of the American political system, it has been from the get-go on constructed in a highly elitist way, so that people have a voice, but not too much, right? So the whole system with the Electoral College, the Senate, and the very bizarre way in which it distorts people's will. So you have these institutional choke points in the system that have always like kind of made it harder for a really powerful people's voice to emerge and kind of influence politics. From time to time, it happens, and clearly the U.S. is a very complex system, but it has this kind of institutional kind of interesting elitism built into it. And when it comes to the Democratic Party, I think it's of course a huge topic, but one striking similarity that I would say is there in the way in which the Hungarian left has collapsed and the way in which the American Democrats have lost some of their base is their kind of deafness to certain social problems and economic frustrations that people have, and the willingness or the unwillingness to take those complaints seriously, to even denigrate and silence those concerns. So that's when you have a situation where, you know, in this classic Northwest Rust Belt, you had a lot of people moving, either not voting Democrats anymore or shifting to the Republican Party. That was crucial.
Right.
So I think what the Democrats need to kind of relearn is how to create a majority that goes beyond their kind of classic progressive strategy that is identifying minorities and then talking to those minorities specifically and hoping that that would add up. But this then led to the Democratic Party even losing out among Black Americans, among Hispanic Americans, right? So they have also moved to the Republican Party. And I think one of the reasons for that is that American voters don't just think in demographic terms. They have their economic pains, they have their social frustrations, they have their political alienation, and you need to take those issues seriously. And the problem is that the Democratic Party, now it's changing and there's a lot of interesting innovation going on, but still the kind of the status quo part, the mainstream part of the Democratic Party, sounds too much like a force that is interested in protecting the status quo. And it's the same in Europe. The Democratic Party sounds like they want to protect the status quo, and it's the radical right that is offering a transformative agenda. And when people are frustrated with the way in which the economy goes, they are looking for a transformative party. And that's, you know, it's a lie that Donald Trump will fix the economy for average working or middle class Americans, but he manages to still to sell himself like that. And this is something that we saw playing out in Hungary with the Socialist Party, the way it collapsed among working class Hungarians. So I think that's a crucial lesson to learn.
Andras, we only have a few minutes left, but when Trump first came to power, you said in interviews that you got contacted by U.S. journalists who wanted some advice on how to cover someone like Trump. Now that we're in this second term and we're seeing a number of unprecedented moves by this administration, what are your thoughts today? I don't know if you pay attention to U.S. media and how they cover Trump, or if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, I do. I do pay attention, although I try to limit my, my daily dose of, Trump and Elon Musk related, news items. I mean, I also have to pay attention to other things in life and in the world. But I think and I completely agree with Gabor's analysis. I think it was really spot on. But the Hungarian media elite and the urban elite, I think they spent the first 10 years of the Orbán government or regime being outraged at the lines that were crossed, the how the democratic institutions were dismantled, the sad reality is that most people or a lot of people don't really pay attention to these stories or to these discussions, because For years, Hungary was doing relatively well because of the world economy was going well because of the EU funds that were coming to Hungary. So actually, the Orbán government delivered in a way and provided some kind of stability, more stability than the previous governments provided. We have the advantage now that we've been living under in this regime for more than 15 years now, and I think now more and more people wake up and they start to realize that actually this system is not delivering that much either. And interesting that we always covered corruption and we exposed a lot of corrupt deals and businesses, and 5, 10 years ago, nobody really paid attention to these stories. But now, when people are struggling in their daily lives, and then suddenly there is more interest in stories that expose how the Orban family or other members of the political elite, they have a luxurious life. We published a documentary. We produced a documentary and we published it in February, which was about the Orban family's businesses. It has nearly 4 million views now on YouTube. It's by far the most popular journalistic or public affairs content ever published on YouTube in Hungarian. So I think that shows that the environment has changed and people are paying more attention to these stories now.
András Petho is a Hungarian journalist and co-founder and director of Direct 36. It is one of the very few outlets in Hungary that are not under the government's influence. It is also independent. In 2014, András resigned from Origo, one of Hungary's leading independent news outlets, after management pressured journalists to drop stories the government did not like. Dr. Gábor Sherin is assistant professor of comparative politics at Georgetown University in Qatar. He was a Green Party member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014. His book is called The Retreat of Liberal Democracy. It examines how working class dislocation and business elite co-optation foster illiberalism. András and Gábor, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you can learn more about what is happening in Hungary. Go to our website, kalw.org, click news and your call. You can also find Gábor and András articles there. Thanks to Johanna Miyake for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Join us this Saturday on Folk Music and Beyond for crossover music with elements of jazz, reggae, hip-hop, and classical. We'll hear from Rhiannon Giddens and the Silk Road Ensemble, New York clarinetist Anat Cohen, Kora Master Sekou Keita, and Welsh harper Katrine Finch. That and more on Folk Music and Beyond this Saturday at 2 on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.